Dr. Ray Goodman, especially along with his wife Betty, were the main proponents and the overseers of this lecture committee. This series was started 25 years ago to honor our minister emeritus, Bernie Pipes, after he had served our congregation for 35 years. But his career during that time and in the years since has served more than just those in this church or our local community. During his years of ministry, Bernie Pipes and his wife, Maggie, worked to assist our society in many notable ways. In the late 1950s, he was the first religious figure in California to perform ceremonies of union and commitment for gay and lesbian couples in the 1950s. He marched with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King in Selma, Alabama. In the Vietnam era, he counseled conscientious objectors. He and Maggie were close allies and friends of Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. He was instrumental in the 1980s in establishing sanctuaries for refugees from the Guatemalan Civil War. Always a strong environmentalist, Ernie has led Earthwatch Institute courses. Throughout the decades, and still today, Ernie's intellect, gentle humor, and compassion have guided and continue to guide not only Unitarians, but all people throughout this region. Ernie recently celebrated his 90th birthday, and we're very pleased that he is with us today. May I invite everyone to recognize a selfless life dedicated to improving the world. Please join with me in thanking and saluting the Reverend Ernie Pipes. Now, a few words about this afternoon's program. Following the lecture presentation, there will be a question and answer period. You will find some 3x5 cards in the pews. Thank you, Diana. And you can submit questions, and people will be circulating to pick them up afterwards. Also, at the end of the presentation, please join us for a reception in Forbes Hall directly through these double doors. This 25th lecture is distinguished in many ways, particularly that we are welcoming back our very first presenter. The Reverend Dr. William F. Schultz has had a most distinguished career in the intervening years, receiving honorary doctorates and recognition throughout the world. Although I don't know that his having given the first lecture is responsible for his subsequent recognition and successes, we here at Santa Monica Unitarian Church like to think so. During his visit 25 years ago, Reverend Schultz spoke about religion in the 21st century. At that time, he was serving as the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. From 1994 through 2006, he was executive director of Amnesty International USA, leading missions to, among others, Liberia, Northern Ireland, and Sudan. Following that period, he returned to our denomination to head the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, retiring this past summer. He has been a consultant for a variety of foundations, was appointed adjunct professor of public administration at New York University, as well as a professor of human rights at the University of Chicago. Currently, he serves as affiliated minister of the First Parish in Bedford, Massachusetts, and affiliated with the Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago, and a senior fellow at the Kennedy Center of Government at Harvard. He is widely published, especially in the field of human rights, leading the New York Review of Books to state, "William Schultz has done more than anyone in the American human rights movement to make human rights issues known in the United States." Drawing on his decades of studies and experience, we are honored that he has come all the way from Massachusetts to present his lecture, "Seeing the Garden, Not Just the Wall." Please welcome the Reverend Dr. William F. Schultz.
Thanks so much, and thanks to Pat and Diana and the committee. It's delightful to be with you. I think we just did this, though, didn't we, a few hours ago? 25 years ago, as Pat said, I was honored to deliver the first Piped lecture, Pipe's lecture, coincident with Ernie's and Maggie's retirement from your ministry. I gather that I talked about religion in the 21st century, but I have no idea what I said, and I doubt whether any of you do either. But I'm certain that I sang the praises of Ernie and Maggie. Ernie, because there has been no minister of my acquaintance for whom I have greater respect. And Maggie, because Maggie was, well, she was Maggie. She was a fireball, a lover of life, a seeker of justice. She was a peach. Maggie helped to get me elected president of the UUA by running my campaign here in the Pacific Southwest. I remember having a dinner with Ernie and Maggie during that campaign. And toward the end of the evening, Maggie and Ernie got into a bit of a tiff about something, probably some political issue where Maggie was taking a far left position and Ernie only a left wing position. But what I remember is that Maggie issued a long and eloquent soliloquy about whatever was bothering her. And when she finally paused for breath, Ernie looked at her, and in that preternaturally calm way of his, he said, "Yup." This, of course, drove her crazy, and she engaged in another fervent soliloquy, to which Ernie again replied, "Yup." I loved Maggie's passion, and I loved Ernie's "Yup." Of course, Ernie, I'm sure, had much more to say than "Yup." Over the years of his ministry, much of it on behalf of the suffering. But the wisdom of his restraint, his "yup," no doubt had something to do with the fact that he served a 35-year tenure in this church. That's almost unheard of in our ministry. But Ernie obviously learned that the best ministers are also exceptionally skilled politicians. Now, I know that politicians don't have the best reputation these days, though, as long as we're disparaging politicians, I'd point out to you that it was a Massachusetts senator who got on statewide radio not too many years ago and declared in loud and fervent tones, "The Republican octopus is spreading its testicles across the entire Commonwealth." But I'm not talking about that kind of politician. The political philosopher T.V. Smith caught the spirit of what I have in mind when he said, "It's the job of the politician to keep the saints and their respective followers from slaughtering one another over matters of moral principle." Or as the great New York Yankees manager Casey Stengel put it, "The secret of a great baseball manager is to keep the three guys who hate your guts away from the five guys who so far are undecided." And that's true for ministers, too. And no doubt it was his great skills, political and otherwise, that bequeathed such a fine church to his successors. But I'm willing to bet that even more important than Ernie's restraint and political skills was that he managed year after year, as all good ministers do, to provide his congregants a reason to hope. It sounds pretty simple, but if a minister has no conviction of hope, it's awfully difficult to sustain oneself, much less one's congregation. So I'm going to talk this afternoon about hope, and specifically hope in the face of the horrors and disappointments and just plain stupidity that plagues our world and that we hear about every day. The slaughter in Syria, the xenophobia in Europe and the United States, the inexorable threat of climate change. What more appropriate season in our national life than now to think a bit about hope? Now, and I am interested in hope for two reasons. One, of course, because I'm often tempted, as I expect many of you are, to have so little of it. I sometimes feel like Charlie Brown did when Lucy said to him, "Charlie Brown, in the great cruise ship of life, some people face their deck chairs to the fore and look at what's coming, and others place theirs to the aft and look at what's past. In the great cruise ship of life, Charlie Brown. Which way is your deck chair facing? And Charlie Brown replied, in the great cruise ship of life, I'm one of those who can't get my deck chair unfolded. But I'm also interested in hope because I am sometimes, against all odds, so filled with it. When I was at Amnesty International, the question I was asked repeatedly for 12 years was this. Given all the horror and carnage that you encounter in your work every day, torture, rape, murder, how do you retain any sense of optimism, of hope, about human nature and the human future? But you know, I did, and I do, and I want to tell you why. And I want to begin first by acknowledging very directly the case against hope. The truth is that the world is full of endless folly. I don't think I have to convince you of that. I don't even need to give you examples of that. The human race may well render the planet uninhabitable. Hope does not always win. Justice does not always prevail. But when we consider the broader human enterprise, the shape of history, I think there is a 60-40 case to be made for hope, for the possibility that the human spirit is not inevitably tainted by ignorance and ignominy. One of the reasons I think that has to do with the nature of power and social change, and two others have to do with characteristics of being human. I was ordained about 41 years ago, and what Cardinal John Patrick Foley's mother said of him might well be said of me. Cardinal Foley grew up in Connecticut, but he was for many years the chief spokesperson for the Vatican, and he was a connoisseur of Italian food. And when he returned to the United States after several years in Rome, his mother took one look at him, and she said, John, there are 20 pounds of you that were not ordained. But I'm not interested so much in how my girth has changed in those 40 years, but in how the world has. In 1975, about a third of the countries in the world were democratic, about a third. Today, more than three-quarters of the world's countries are at least putative democracies. In the first 75 years of the 20th century, only four women served as heads of state. 75 years. Since then, there have been 41 more, maybe a 42nd on the way. In 1975, nobody knew there was even such a thing as global warming. Today, it is on the lips of a multitude. In 1975, it was impossible to imagine a world without an Iron Curtain, a world without apartheid in South Africa, a world without a battle-scarred Northern Ireland. It was impossible to imagine the United States with an African-American president. How did these things, and many others that I could mention, how did they change, and change for the better? When I was in graduate school, I wore a pair of turquoise paisley pants every day for 4 years. I wore them proudly and without embarrassment. In fact, I was the envy of the University of Chicago campus. Why is it that not a single graduate student in the United States would be caught dead today wearing purple paisley pants? It's because fashion norms change, and as norms change, so does the configuration of power. Over the past 40 years, indeed since the end of World War II, we have seen a radical shift in global norms, a shift in the direction of greater openness to diverse voices, of a more equitable distribution of power, and even, contrary to what we think we know intuitively, we have seen a significant reduction in violence. Now, of course, it's true that global poverty remains stubbornly unmitigated, that Israelis and Palestinians still haunt each other's dreams, that corporate profits still favor the 1%. As the protest signs of the Occupy movement put it, nobody with four aces asks the dealer to deal again. But if we follow the advice of one of the greatest philosophers of all time, Baruch Spinoza, who said, in effect, always take the view from eternity, if we take the long view, if we consider that just 250 years ago, virtually no one opposed slavery, no one supported universal suffrage, no one opposed the subjugation of women, and today, no reputable person, I underscore reputable, would support any of them. If we take this perspective, if we look at human history, not in Aldous Huxley's famous phrases, one damn thing after another, but if we see human history in its totality, it is impossible to argue credibly that on balance, humankind has not made enormous progress. Now, could the human race regress? Absolutely, and inevitably it will. We all may go back to wearing turquoise paisley pants. Is progress guaranteed? Absolutely not. History is not fated. It's not determined to move in any particular direction, good or bad. But thus far, and on balance, the shift in norms, and hence in power, has largely been in a progressive direction. The radical journalist I.F. Stone put it this way, the only kinds of fights worth fighting are those you're going to lose, because somebody has to fight them and lose and lose and lose until the day when somebody who believes as you do finally wins. When we look at the sweep of history, the odds in favor of hope are at least 60 to 40. But perhaps this is a bit too esoteric to be of real comfort, so I want to offer you two more practical reasons for hope in the human enterprise, both of which emerge from my observations of human beings. The first is an observation about human resilience. When the British began in earnest to climb Mount Everest, the Tibetans who served as their porters were dumbfounded. Tibetans have no word for the summit of the mountain. And when they saw the great sacrifices the British were making, losing limbs to frostbite, losing their lives to falls, one of the High Lamas said, "I felt great compassion for them to suffer so much for such meaningless work." But one of the great privileges of my life has been to come to know so many people who suffered so much for such important work. What has always astonished me about those I have known who were victims of human rights abuses was that if they survived the death threats or the years of unjust imprisonment or the torture, it was because they never gave up. They endured greater suffering than you and I could ever imagine. They sustained deep wounds, often scarred for life, both emotionally and physically. But time after time, they were prepared to re-engage in the struggle for justice. What kind of stubbornness, what devotion does it take to have your two little girls kidnapped by Guatemalan death squads, then murdered, to not be able for 20 years to speak of them without tears, but then to become an outspoken advocate for other people's human rights? That's the story of one of my most effective staff members at Amnesty International. Nick Yaris spent 23 years in prison for a murder he did not commit, and when he was exonerated and released and asked how he felt, he said, "What are my choices? I could be really devastated and angry and let them continue to own me, or I could have fun. Having fun with the rest of my life sounds better. The lowest insult would be if I came out destroyed, a broken man. My survival technique was to become a good man." Prezak Gary was tortured mercilessly in a South American prison, and many years later, walking along the street, he ran into the man who had tortured him. The torturer was among those who were at that time being prosecuted, and he tried to avoid Perez's gaze, but Perez took the initiative. "How are you?" he asked his torturer. The man said he was being prosecuted and was very depressed. There was a long pause, and then Perez said, "If you need anything, come to see me." And then he said, "Shake hands, friend. I forgive you." The resilience of the human spirit is so profound, not in every instance, but in so many, that I would be guilty of the worst form of narcissism if I gave up hope in human transformation when so many others who have seen humanity at its worst have managed not to. But of course, heroes and heroines like those people are very rare. Few of us display that kind of resilience in the face of agony, but what large numbers of people are able to feel is another's pain. If resilience is unusual, generosity of spirit is far more commonplace than we acknowledge. I'll give you an example. A few months after the horrendous genocide in Rwanda in 1994, a team of reconciliation experts went to that tattered country to help the Tutsis, those of the Tutsi tribe, 800,000 of whom had just been slaughtered by members of the Hutu tribe, to help the Tutsis begin the process of healing and forgiveness. For several hours, the experts conducted their training, inviting members of the village from different tribes to share their feelings with one another. But finally, one of the village elders said, "You know, all this is good, but what we really need in this village is a bus." The reconciliation experts were taken aback. "Yes," they said, "perhaps the village does need a bus, but we're here to talk about far more important things." But the elder persisted. "We need a bus," he said. And soon all the villagers were chanting, "A bus, a bus, a bus." And finally, one of the women in the group explained. "We need a bus," she said, "a bus that will start its route in the Hutu part of the region and then drive to the Pygmy part and then to the Tutsi part and then back again. And we want to design the seats of the bus so that all the seats face one another. And we want to have a rule that no one may sit beside a person of their own tribe. And we want to have conductors who one day are Hutu, and the next day are Pygmy, and the next day are Tutsi. And by the way, we want all the conductors to be women." There are many reasons that I agreed 6 years ago to be president of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, from which job I just retired, but the most important one is because UUSC makes it so easy for every one of us to be generous of heart and to stand side by side with the less fortunate. I'm going to give you just one example. About 4 years ago, I traveled to Burma, what is now known as Myanmar, and when I was at Amnesty, I wouldn't have been allowed inside Myanmar, but this time I received a visa upon my airport arrival. I drove 4 hours northeast of Mandalay into villages so remote that one had never seen a foreigner before. I went there because UUSC had started 12 credit unions in collaboration with a network of Buddhist monasteries. Before that had happened, the villagers paid 25% to a middleman when they needed to borrow money. They went across the border to China and paid a 25% interest charge. But now each week, the women of the village go to the monastery and deposit their dollar or $1.50 into the credit union, and they earn 4% interest. Some of you may want to consider shifting your investments. Today, there are 300 villages being served by UUSC credit unions. And now that Burma is becoming more open politically, those credit unions are becoming centers for political organizing. One village, for example, got sick of the military coming in and stealing their sand. So the credit union wrote a letter to the local paper, and astonishingly, seeing the village united, the military stopped stealing the sand. No one can understand what UUSC, a very small organization, is doing and not feel hope in the human future. Now, I know, many of those who commit the most horrible crimes suffer no remorse. Believe me, I know that. I think it was Heinrich Himmler who said, it was a terrible thing we had to do, killing people every day and then going home to our children. We are the ones you should feel sorry for. Yes, I know. But far, far more people are touched by the sight of the injured, moved by the fate of the fallen, and prepared, when their leaders be wise and their laws be just, to extend their hands to the helpless and their hearts to the hopeless. We need not be among the hopeless, for the sweep of history carries promise of our redemption, powered as it is, sustained as it is, by both resilience and generosity of spirit. Those are the reasons for hope, relentless, undaunted, courageous. That's why I've not chosen to give up on the human project. What we need is a bus. 60-40, those odds may not be the best in the world, but when you consider what we're up against, I'll take them any day, those odds, and so should you. And then there's one final reason for hope, and that is this. Walls seem to be in the news a lot lately. The Hungarians have built a wall along their border to keep Syrian refugees out, and a certain orange-haired candidate keeps promising to build a beautiful one on our southern border. When Israel built its wall along the Green Line to separate itself from the West Bank, Hani Amer, a Palestinian farmer, discovered that the wall would cut right through his property. So he petitioned the Israelis to preserve his land, and to his surprise, they did. They built a loop in the wall around his garden and erected a gate that he can pass through for 15 minutes every 24 hours to tend his olive, fig, apple, peach, and plum trees. Now, it's hardly an ideal solution, I grant you, but when Hani was asked how he managed to keep up his spirits, he replied very simply, "Instead of seeing the wall, I concentrate on seeing the garden." And that's what every purveyor of hope does. That's what Ernie did for 41 years of his active memory. That's what keeps hope alive for the rest of us. We know, of course, that there is a wall, but we never take our eyes off the garden. How can we not find hope and solace and treasure in a world that could produce an Ernie and Maggie Pipes who spent and have spent their lives never taking their eyes off the garden? Thank you.
Well, I certainly thank Reverend Dr. Schultz for those inspirational words, and I invite any and all of you, if you have any questions or comments that you would like to share, there are the 3x5 cards there. And there we have party volunteers ready to take any questions that you may have. If you would just hold them up and they'll get them. And I will take the moderator's privilege to ask, if I may, the first question. In your wealth of experience, especially in going to areas that are, shall I modestly say, risky, did you ever feel unsafe, or did you ever fear? And how then might you have handled that?
Yes, I did a lot of ducking, actually. There were two instances in which I faced down some unpleasant interlocutors, shall we say. One was in Liberia in the middle of the Civil War when Charles Taylor, who fortunately is currently in prison in The Hague, was running for president of Liberia on the slogan, "Vote for me or I'll kill you." And he won. He won the election, not surprisingly. I was leading an amnesty delegation to Liberia in the middle of the war, and one of the opposition newspapers asked me, should war criminals be allowed to run for president? And I said, Amnesty takes no position on political candidates, but of course we believe that war criminals or those accused of war crimes should be brought to justice. Well, the next day in the newspaper, huge headlines, Taylor may not run for president, says Amnesty International's Dr. William Schultz. So I went into the newspaper and I said, you've got to correct that. That's not what I said. And I reiterated what I said. Oh, we understand. We understand. The next day, even bigger headlines, you will be booked, meaning Charles Taylor. You will be booked, says Dr. Schultz of Amnesty International. So that evening, I went to a reception, and Charles Taylor's right-hand woman, a woman named Millie Buchanan, said to me, Dr. Schultz, Mr. Taylor is very concerned about your health. He asked me to tell you that you will be booked with a bullet if you ever return to Liberia, and keep your eye on your back in New York. So I'm happy that Charles Taylor is in prison. And also in Sudan, there were child soldiers there who held up our car. So, yes, this has happened, but on balance, I will say that because Amnesty never went into a country without the permission of the government and was therefore under the at least alleged protection of the government, for the most part, these were idle threats or concerns.
We have a series of questions that have come forward. We have one that says, what do you suggest the UUSC and the United States generally, what should their role be to stop what is going on in Syria?
So I, now that I'm freed from the constraint at Amnesty, in which Amnesty takes no position on these types of things, I personally believe and have believed since the beginning of the conflict that there should be a no-fly zone established over parts of Syria. I know that this is a complicated equation, but I think it is unlikely and unwise to engage American troops in Syria. And yet at the same time, I believe that we have not only a moral obligation, but I think we have a political obligation to do what we can, even if it's not successful, to protect those who are experiencing horrendous suffering. So that's the least that I think we should do.
Thank you. This one is more of a political nature, shall I say, but it reads, based on your work with UUSC in Haiti, do you think criticism of the Clinton Foundation in that country is warranted?
Well, I will say that what is certainly true is that multiple millions of dollars, not just by the Clinton Foundation, but by the Red Cross and many others, poured into Haiti after the 2010 earthquake, and the results have been astonishingly meager. I can't just hold the Clinton Foundation accountable, though it may well be. But and why is this? It is because almost all American aid agencies, and this is certainly true of USAID, have one template for how to solve problems in the face of various humanitarian crises. And they are very reticent to listen to the people on the ground, to adapt that template to the particular circumstances in which they find themselves. And the result is that there is often a great deal of money wasted. And this is also why the Service Committee, of course, at a very modest level, perhaps $2.5 million. But this is why the service committee went in, and before we did any projects at all, we undertook a collaboration with local folks in Haiti, and it was their suggestions that then guided the service committee eventually in the creation of what are called eco-villages, and I won't go into the details of that, but that really is the critical feature, whether it's UUSC, USAID, the Clinton Foundation, or anyone else.
This question states that it is the writer's understanding that Amnesty International supports Edward Snowden's actions and efforts, and wondered what your reaction is to that.
I don't know what. I thank God I'm not responsible any longer for Amnesty International, and I don't know what its position on Edward Snowden is. I think there's no question that Edward Snowden and his revelations have played a critical role in raising concerns about privacy that ought indeed to be raised, and it is also true that part of the results of that are that we're seeing this in the hacking of not only the Clinton emails but of Twitter and many other vehicles of digital communication. So I think this is a two-edged sword and a very, very complicated issue that I'm not qualified technically to comment on.
All right. Thank you. There are a couple of questions here that deal with Unitarianism, so
okay.
I will try to combine them.
I'm not responsible any longer for that, just as long as you know that. It's great to be semi-retired, I'll tell you that. Yes, go right ahead, and I'll deflect those questions, too.
Yes. But the gist of them is, what is, shall we say, the hope for the UU religion in today's world, and how do you feel the Unitarian Universalist religion has changed in the time that you have been involved with it in response to how the world has changed?
So the fundamental change for all religious institutions is that a new generation is far less committed to institutions in general, not just the church, but a whole variety of institutions, and relationships are built not only digitally, but in informal settings that don't require formal membership in an organization or a pledge or a formal commitment. And this is, at least for the time being, this is the ethos that permeates the newest generations. And this is a challenge to all religious institutions. And religious institutions are going to have to adapt to that in the form of finding additional mechanisms, not mechanisms that replace traditional churches, but additional vehicles and mechanisms for building religious community and for helping people to explore fundamental religious questions, which people certainly are deeply interested in and committed to, without having to make formal, at least in the traditional sense, a formal commitment to a particular bricks-and-mortar type institution. This is tough for all of us, and I include myself, who are committed to traditional bricks-and-mortar institutions. So this has to be not an either-or, but an additive factor to what we do. And there are many younger ministers who are exploring exactly what that means and who are connecting with large groups of people digitally, who are conducting ministries outside of a bricks and mortar church by meeting at various times of the week in community centers and private homes and Starbucks and a variety of different places with smaller groups of younger people who are deeply committed both to exploring religious questions and to being engaged in justice work. And figuring out that equation, that is the challenge for Unitarian Universalist leaders going forward. There are three candidates for the new president of the UUA, and these are good questions to put to those three candidates.
Well, this then may be another sort of follow-up question, but it has been posed along with two others, basically addressing education. What do you see the role of Unitarian Universalists in improving education, not only here in the United States, but also for the world's children, to perhaps ensure a more humanitarian future?
Well, that's a pretty broad question. You know, let me step back and make a and take that question at a more meta level, if you will. I think that we make a mistake when we try to presume that Unitarian Universalism, which consists in this country of about 130,000 adults and 25,000 to 30,000 young people, can impact in a profound way any global issue by ourselves. We simply can't do it. That is to not understand how social change takes place. What we can do, whether it be in the field of education or any other area of social change, we can do two things. One is we can help build coalitions with other like-minded people who collectively have much more power than we do. And the second thing we can do is that we can find those particular issues where a progressive voice has not yet been widely articulated, and we can articulate that ahead of time, ahead of its time, just as Ernie did with same-sex union services in 1959. You know, somebody has to go first on these things. And historically, not always, but historically, Unitarians and Universalists have often been the ones to go first. We can't do it by ourselves, but we can often shame others or at least begin to push those norms in the progressive direction that I described in my remarks. So I don't know what we can do about worldwide global education except be part of larger groups that are focused on that particular issue. But I do know that we can make a very profound impact on a wide variety of issues in the two ways that I just articulated.
Well, you've been very, very kind in answering a variety of questions, and I think we will end with one final one that you may have the answer for.
I'm sure I will.
Of course. And that is, did the Tutsis get their bus?
As far as I know, yes, they did get their bus. Now, whether it had the impact that they were anticipating, I don't know. But I believe that they did get their bus. Okay, pleasure to be with you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. You are all welcome to join us for the reception afterwards.